This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of Analysis. Today, entrepreneur and former CEO Margaret Heffernan asks, is talent a thing? Companies try to hire the best talent, and many of us believe some people are talented and others not. But could ability be down to very different qualities instead?
When I was at school, they'd never heard of dyslexia. They just thought I was stupid. And I actually left school at 15 because I was hopeless at school and started a magazine to give young people a chance to have a voice and campaign on issues they felt strongly about.
Richard Branson, now a billionaire businessman.
I hated school.
Whoopi Goldberg.
Well, they assumed I was being lazy because I was so smart and other ways. There were things I could do and I could remember things, and so they knew I wasn't dumb. They just thought I was being lazy. Something was different about me.
One of the few people to have won an Oscar, an Emmy, a Tony, and a Grammy.
I remember my special needs group at school, you know, special needs and bottom group and all that sort of stuff.
Jamie Oliver, TV chef and entrepreneur.
But at the same time, I always could cook already at that stage. So I didn't really care about that negativity that was going on in my life.
These are all super successful people who were overlooked and undervalued at school. Theirs was not just random bad luck. They fell victim to the belief that some special people are talented, but the rest aren't. And even worse, that somebody with one test or another can select for it. I'm Margaret Heffernan, and yes, there is a reason I identify with such people. At the age of 18, I was told in no uncertain terms by the headmistress of my proud London girls' school that I wasn't university material. Only my father's stubbornness got me to Cambridge. I've run 5 businesses, employing hundreds of people here and in the US, and seen firsthand just how much more capable, creative, and productive most people are than any grades or tests ever show.
My name is Tracy Woodward, and I am 51 years of age, and I'd like to be known as Tracy.
Born premature to a teenage mum with an unstable lifestyle, Tracy was more of a carer than a pupil. At age 14, she still couldn't read.
I probably did about 2 years of schooling maximum, you know, 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there. By that stage, I'd done such little schooling in juniors and infants that I'd already passed through the system. You know, those days, it's quite easy just to write you off. And then I worked for Kingswood Chemists in West Norwood at 14. That's where I had my aha moment, because everybody in the store on a Thursday and Saturday that I was there could, you know, sign off on prescriptions, take people's details, could do everything. And I couldn't. And I used to say to the pharmacist, I still want to be able to do the prescriptions. And he says, but if you can't read, you can't do it. And he said, but you are so bright and so capable. Why can't you read? And I think that was the moment when I thought, actually, why can't I read?
Today, Tracy Woodward is CEO of Aromatherapy Associates, employing over 200 people worldwide. But it wasn't grades and tests that got her to the top. It was mindset.
The qualities that got me where I am today was one thing my mum always said to me from a very young age. You know what, Tracy, whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. That has stood with me my entire life. And I say it to my kids. But I think that a little bit of self-belief, a little bit of tenacity, a little bit of determination, and actually not being ashamed to say, I don't know or I don't understand, was a gift.
Tracy had gifts. They just weren't the kind that anybody tested for. The idea that there is such a thing as talent, that it can be found through testing and grades, is problematic for 2 reasons. First, believing that talent is precious and rare is wasteful because it writes off most people. Secondly, it assumes that academic performance guarantees high achievement throughout life, but that isn't borne out by research or by experience.
When I joined, it was all about academic pedigree. It was all about test scores, how you did. It kind of bugged me.
Laszlo Bock ran people operations at Google for 10 years when the company grew from 5,000 to over 50,000 employees.
And after a number of years of research and analytics, we were able to demonstrate that those signifiers that we typically look to in terms of, you know, who's talented, who's not, actually are by and large not predictive of actual performance. And it turns out academic performance doesn't really predict much. As an employer, those are not very reliable signals. It turns out the reason people don't go to Ivy League schools is typically because their family's not affluent, or they didn't have a track to it, or nobody told them, or they didn't have role models. And those are all great, exceptional people that you should try to hire.
But the proxy for finding those exceptional people tends to be intelligence. Almost nobody has studied intelligence for as long and in such depth as Professor James Flynn of the University of Otago in New Zealand. So I asked him whether it was a useful way of assessing people's potential.
Really, you should judge people by their efforts to do cognitively demanding things and see whether or not they succeed. And you should all the way along be looking for non-cognitive factors that may cripple them, such as a marriage breakdown in their home, or they've fallen in with the wrong set at school who laugh at them if they do their homework.
Flynn's big discovery, which came to be widely known as the Flynn effect, was that intelligence isn't static or fixed, and that average levels of intelligence actually rose over the course of the 20th century. This was largely due to better schooling and cognitively more demanding jobs as people moved away from manual labor. So ability is dynamic. It can grow or shrink.
In Holland, we find evidence that adults are still making IQ gains. Presumably, the jobs are still very demanding. That high school students, if anything, are showing slight losses, which is certainly a warning to the Dutch educational system, while preschoolers are about the same, which means that parents are giving them the same preschool environment. So when you look at IQ gains, you have to look at them by age. And you can certainly find that schools are not developing talent to the same degree that the world of work does later on or that parents do before school.
That failure of testing accurately to predict achievement in later life, together with growing awareness of how deeply grades are influenced by economic and family background, has led a host of researchers to question whether the idea of talent has any meaning or utility at all. James Flynn shows intelligence changes over time. Pushed, it grows. Abandoned, overlooked, it won't. Research also shows that it's highly responsive to context, whether your teacher believes in you and whether your parents are interested in you. Even more influential, though, changing the way that our schools and organizations think about ability, is the work of Stanford professor of psychology, Carol Dweck. Her research shows that how you think about talent changes what you can achieve.
What we find is that some people favor a fixed mindset, the idea that their talents and abilities are just these fixed traits. You have a certain amount, that's it. Other people have a different view, a growth mindset, the idea that their talents and abilities can be developed through mentorship, hard work, good strategies. They don't think everyone's the same, but they believe everyone can develop. Everyone can learn and get smarter.
And I think one of the things I'm very struck by is you make a distinction between growth mindset and fixed mindset for how people deal with difficulties, challenges, and mistakes.
Yes. When you have a fixed mindset, you're afraid of challenges because a failure or a mistake can discredit your ability. And if a failure or mistake occurs, you get mighty discouraged because you start wondering, maybe I don't have it after all. But in a growth mindset, challenges, mistakes, setbacks, these are the ways you learn and grow. We've shown in many studies that people with the latter view tend to go farther. They love challenges. They know how to persist when things are tough. They know how to bounce back.
What was it that led you into this observation that there are, if you like, two really diametrically opposed mm-hmm. mindsets. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so much of the field in which you work has been dominated by the notion of intelligence yes. and measuring intelligence. Yes. So what led you kind of away from that thing of let's nail it down yes. and measure it
yes.
to framing it yes. as mindsets?
Yes, a few things. My sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Wilson, seated us around the room in IQ order. Everybody had these enormous capabilities, and yet once we got to her class, if you weren't at the top, you didn't count.
Dweck is one of the big beasts of social psychology, so I couldn't resist asking her, where in Mrs. Wilson's class had she been positioned?
Well, I have to admit I sat in the first row, first seat. So that was the place of pride, the seat of honor. But I have to admit it instilled in me a longstanding fear of losing that position, of doing anything that could discredit my intelligence. And it's only when I began to study this topic that I became courageous and went out there seeking challenges. I sat in fear that the next test could displace me, or when a new student entered the class in the middle of the year, instead of saying, maybe she'll be a good friend, I thought, oh, I hope she doesn't take my seat.
That's fascinating, because it means that even though that system rewarded you, it harmed you.
Yes. A large part of my mission is to prevent that harm for kids and release people from that harmful effect.
So testing can't be relied upon to assess accurately the lifelong capability of an individual. Even those who are rewarded by the process, deemed talented or high potential, can be constrained by it, isolated, and frightened. That's one reason why, over the last few years, so many companies have thrown away their grading and ranking systems, because they just don't work. They often reinforce the fixed mindset, believing that you either have talent or not, and made people give up when they encountered a challenge they couldn't easily resolve. But in organizations characterized by growth mindset, people tend to persevere, and in the course of sticking at it, they learn more and they learn better. In her early career as a classroom teacher, Professor Angela Duckworth noted something similar, as she told me on a Skype call when I was in Texas and she was at the University of Pennsylvania.
Working with teenagers who were trying to learn math and science, like seeing some kids thrive and other kids flounder and not being able to explain this fully with their intelligence. I mean, it's not to say that there weren't differences in their ability, but really I couldn't fully explain my grades that I had to give out at the end of the year just by their IQ alone. And so that led me really to this very broad question, which is like, what else is there other than your intellect that would make you successful or not in your life?
This led her to focus on the concept that has made her name, grit. Duckworth says grit is more important for success than IQ. So what is it?
I define grit as the combination of having incredible passion for a long-term goal of really meaningful personal significance, but then also the perseverance to go with it. So really caring about something and staying committed to it, but then working very hard toward making that goal a reality. And I'm not saying that any of us could be everything, because I don't believe that's true. I don't think anybody could be Einstein or anybody could be Mozart or Picasso. But I do also think that Mozart at some point didn't know how to compose and play music, that Picasso at some point was not the artist that he eventually became. And there's a journey there. How far along that path each of us might go does have some genetic constraint. I do believe that there are innate differences among us that will limit to some extent what we do. But I also believe that we can, for the most part, go much farther than we think we can.
Duckworth claims that grit shows up in deliberate practice. This is more than the 10,000 hours made famous by Anders Ericsson and Malcolm Gladwell. It's about having the humility to notice your mistakes, being open to feedback, and to weaknesses.
Many people, if not most people, when they practice, they just do the same thing that they did last time without that intentionality, without that focus on weaknesses, without that feedback, without those adjustments. And I think that's the real difference between the people that I study and that Anders study and mediocrity, which is doing the same thing that you did yesterday.
But even a growth mindset with deliberate practice and thousands of hours can't fully explain every achievement in life. Take Matthew Side, a former Olympic table tennis player. He was British number one for 10 years. He's now a journalist and author of Black Box Thinking. He argues that his success as a table tennis player didn't just depend on practice. It required people and places.
About half of the top players in Britain at that time didn't just come from the same town or even the same suburb as me, but the same street. Silverdale Road in Reading. Not all of them became national champion, but they were great county players. There was a Commonwealth champion, many internationals, and it's a very anonymous street. And I began to think about the cultural context through which we had become successful. First of all, we had a brilliant coach, probably the best coach in the country, a guy called Peter Charters, who gave us access to rich and empowering learning experiences. We also had healthy competition, of course, between the people on the street who are improving at table tennis and comparing ourselves with each other. But the crucial thing is that we had a 24-hour-a-day purpose-built table tennis club, and everybody on the street had a set of keys, so you could go in any time of night or day, turn on the lights, and practice. And we did this before school, after school, weekends, holidays. We were really up for table tennis. And that's why a pretty ordinary cohort of young people became extraordinary.
Creating the conditions in which ordinary people can become extraordinary should be what all education and work is about. But how can you tell who's up for that? The belief that you'll know talent when you see it doesn't hold water. 85 years of research showed that the typical unstructured interview was a poor predictor of performance. Laszlo Bock.
It turns out the best validated, most predictive way to assess a candidate for a job is with something called a work sample test, which makes sense. So if you're hiring academics, look at how they did academically. If you're hiring consultants, accountants, finance people, salespeople, marketing people, what have you, look at how they perform in those things, look at their general cognitive ability, and then look at their ability to grow and learn.
By far the least important attribute Google screens for, Bock says, is whether someone actually knows anything about the job they're taking on. Crunching the data on successful hiring led Google instead to look specifically for five characteristics: humility, conscientiousness, a sense of responsibility not to quit until the job's done well, comfort with ambiguity, a sense of fun, and courage. Why courage?
Well, it's about the importance of people being able to raise their voices in organizations. One of the things that happens is when organizations get large, people stop raising their voices, and really bad things happen as a result. You know, that's where you get whistleblowing, insider trading, all kinds of things. Human beings are fundamentally, we're evolved biologically as social, hierarchy-seeking animals. We tend to conform. And so courage is important because the really innovative, creative stuff comes from, I got this crazy idea. And the bad problems get flagged by people who are willing to sort of raise their hand and say, I don't think this is a good thing to do. And without that, you can't do great things.
Great things is what every organization hopes its people will do. But binary judgments about those people, thinking of them as talented or not, smart or not, doesn't help. Thinking about ability so simplistically doesn't illuminate capacity, it wastes it.
You put people in the wrong buckets all the time. One of the questions I asked while I was there was, is high performance sustainable? Right. So, you know, because what a lot of companies like to do is they have a high potential program and you're anointed as a star in your career and you get mentorship and all these opportunities and this beautiful path opens ahead of you. And 10 years later, 15, they say, this person's amazing. What companies never do is they don't look at the people who washed out of those programs, which they do. And more importantly, there's all kinds of selection bias in who you put in those kinds of programs. So at Google, we resisted and don't have high potential. I mean, as long as I was there, didn't have high potential programs. So I asked the team, let's explore this. We have people who we think are superstars. Is that sustainable over a career? And the company at the time was less than 15 years old, so we couldn't do a full career. But what we found was that high performance, meaning you end up in the top 10%, is in fact not sustainable over a career, over a 10-year period. Part of it is, as you move up, the different skill sets are required in different jobs. So this is classic Peter principle. But what also happens is people have different things come up in their lives. They have kids, they have discretionary effort that kind of comes in for men or for women. They also explore, they go laterally, they do different things. And it's unlikely that the cleverness that allows you to solve this particular problem at age 22 will allow you to solve a very different kind of problem at age 32. And so the challenge is, as human beings, we like to put people in buckets. That's how our brains work. That really breaks organizations because people get put in buckets, sheep and goats. That persists for a really long time. So buckets are very dangerous when it comes to figuring out how to run organizations and place people. You should really assess always and without bias.
It's really interesting. I remember when I first encountered that term, hypos, you know, the high potentials. I remember thinking, well, what's everybody else?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what are you saying to the vast majority of your workforce? We're saying, actually, we don't think you have much potential.
Yeah.
And yet you're also saying to them, by the way, could you please bring your best game to work each day?
Yes.
Well, why?
Yeah.
What for?
Yeah.
You know, you've already undervalued me, and now you want me to over-deliver. I mean, it's just, it seems perverse.
It's, as we would say, it's a real bummer.
If high potential programs are a bummer, Bock found that interviews for hiring or promotion were troubling too. Company data showed that it took at least 4 interviews from in-house recruiters to managers, peers, and subordinates to achieve any accuracy in selection. Even people who conducted hundreds of interviews misjudged 1 in 6. Privately, dozens of HR directors have told me something similar, that most interviewing processes just don't work. As a young organizational psychologist, Geraldine Haley did her dissertation on the interview process.
To my extreme surprise, as I observed these panel interviews, I realised that the chairman of the panel took some time to summarise the candidate's CV before the panel interview started. And as I observed this process, I realised that actually the chairman was either consciously or unconsciously, seeming to either favour or raise some doubts about the candidate's suitability. And I was able to predict before the interview started whether or not the candidate, who hadn't entered the room at this point, was going to be selected or not.
As global head of executive talent at Standard Chartered Bank, Geraldine Haley insisted that the interview process, while imperfect, could be improved upon with training and structure.
Your job as an interviewer is not to look in a crystal ball and try and use your intuition to imagine them in a future state and what they'd be like. Your job as an interviewer is to be a sort of forensic investigator and get them to tell stories about experiences or situations they've been in the past and how they've tackled them. So you're looking for evidence, hard evidence, of how these people have made choices about what they've done in the past, what their habits are, what their beliefs are, what excites them, what their strengths are. And that's difficult to do.
So nobody's an instinctive talent scout. What's required is a more disciplined, careful assessment of the job and the person.
The worst thing is if somebody finishes an hour-long interview and then can immediately say whether they want to hire the person or not. I mean, that's a real red flag because it's a feeling reaction, not a fact reaction. If you want a fact reaction, you have to go back over all the evidence you've gathered and really try and match the stories you've got with the future position and see whether you think there's a match or not. And that's quite a scientific and detailed process.
But Haley also found that more than talent or expertise, what really made a difference was how people behaved, and what's more, how their behaviour was aligned with company values.
The bank I worked for many years had a very different culture from many of the other banks. And we acknowledged that and we thankfully understood that. And therefore, looking at the individual's ability to not only bring across their technical knowledge, but to bring across their cultural fit, the way they interact with people, particularly the way they approach challenges. And particularly in the organisation I was in, it was a very non-competitive environment. It was very much a team environment. I always called it a phone-a-friend culture. And that didn't sit well with many people that were coming from the investment banks at the time, where it was much more competitive and almost accepted that you could trample over people if it meant that you delivered your results and you got your bonus. And those sorts of people we tried to select out from the organisation I was in, but we always checked for cultural fit above technical ability at the end of the day.
A panel of four interviewers, the forensic assessment of behaviour, a deep analysis of cultural fit, this all makes interviewing so time-consuming and expensive that some companies hope artificial intelligence can provide a cheaper, faster solution. But even at Google, Laszlo Bock didn't think that was the answer.
The downside, which is very real, is the way most machine learning works is you take a data set and you feed that into a machine, and then you say, here's the success outcome. So here's everyone who applied. Here's everyone we hired. Find people like that. These are therefore successful candidates. And the problem is hiring processes typically have tremendous bias in them around academic pedigree, against certain races, against certain genders. And so if all you do is say, here's all the resumes we looked at and here's the people we hired, find more like that, you're going to end up with an algorithm that says only hire people from Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, Stanford. And you'll miss a lot of really highly qualified people who bring a lot to the game.
So even with artificial intelligence, any definition of talent risks wasting too many great people. Talent, it seems to me, isn't a thing. It resists simple measurements, grades, or assessments. Instead, it's like a mythical beast, something everyone believes in but can't pin down. Trying to select for it at any age fails almost everybody. Today, psychologists mostly consider that if there is such a thing as talent, it shows up as a capacity for learning and persistence. That, after all, is what saved Tracy Woodward.
Every time I've taken a job in the first 10 years, I was completely out of my depth, I think. But I was prepared to learn, and I was prepared to, you know, if it took me 16 hours to do something that might take somebody 8 hours, I would do it.
Developing that capacity to learn and to keep learning throughout life has never been more critical. Why? Because we have no idea today what we or our children will need to know or be able to do 20 or 30 years from now. Nobody, after all, was teaching the internet 30 years ago. But while knowledge won't predict achievement, the love of learning just might.
Analysis was presented by Margaret Heffernan and produced by Arlene Gregorius. In the next edition, Rosie Campbell asks a deceptively simple question: how do we decide who to vote for? You'll find these and many other programmes on the BBC Radio 4 website. And why not give us a review or a rating on your podcast provider? Or get in touch with us directly. The address is analysis@bbc.co.uk.